What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Why am I operating the untested nuclear laser?
You have the longest arms. This is just a little bit of grounding so you don't die immediately.
What kind of grounding do I need for our Ghostbusters review, Adam? Or is that a question for producer Golden Joe Dassault?
I guess it depends on whether you're planning on using an untested nuclear laser as part of your always thoughtful critical analysis of the film. Either way, Joe's your guy. We'll get to a review of the fiercely debated Ghostbusters reboot, remake, rehash.
Just go with a reheat. I always go with a reheat.
Plus my interview with the director of The Witness, a great new documentary out in limited release this weekend about the 50-year-old Kitty Genovese murder case. That and more.
This show is headed for a disaster of biblical proportions.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including gold-level donor Susan Montooth in Mountain View, California, and new $5 a month subscriber Andrew Lewis from Detroit.
My first episode of Film Spotting was the American Gangster Review. I think it may have been 2007, Andrew says. I was a college freshman and was dipping my toe into the world of cinema. I vividly remember searching iTunes for a movie podcast. The rest is history, I guess. I can't begin to tell you how much your podcast has meant to me. Without film, I would not be the person I am, and without Film Spotting, I would not have the passion for film that I do.
American Gangster, a movie I was a little bit disappointed in at the time of its release. Eminently rewatchable on HBO, though.
Good to know.
There you go. Our thanks to Andrew, our thanks to Susan, and to all of our regular monthly donors. And speaking of iTunes, a no-cost way you can help the show, rate or review us on iTunes. Since we've been making this request a little more directly and assertively, Josh, over the past couple months, we have had a little more visibility on iTunes. Is it related? Who knows? But it certainly can't hurt, so please do keep those ratings and reviews coming. We thank Connor Green Holsch and Gabriel 2494, who posted quick reviews over the past week. A little bit later in the show, we'll get to my conversation with the director of the documentary The Witness, James Solomon. And for our podcast listeners, they'll get the fourth film in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon, Suzanne Beer's In a Better World.
But first, I walked into our showing of Ghostbusters last Sunday night saying to Adam, I could really use a good comedy right now. I walked out saying, well, we'll get to that in a moment.
It will haunt you every night. Whatever it is, no one should have to encounter that kind of evil. Except you girls, I think you can handle it.
Oh, all good, thanks.
We have a gift. We see what no one else is willing to see. We do things others can't do.
Ghostbusters.
If there's a paranormal problem, we're the ones to answer the call.
Hello.
The most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
What do we think of these Ghostbusters? Are they to be taken seriously?
You take that aisle, I'll take the far one.
Okay, you sweaty freaks. I'm about to save you from this ghost.
Okay, so I don't know if it was a race thing or a lady thing, but I'm mad as hell.
It's obviously not uncommon for a movie to be greenlit without a finished script, especially in this age of Ultron. But has there ever been a screenplay that was more directly influenced by the often hostile, head-shaking reaction to said movie's greenlighting than Paul Feig's Ghostbusters? Appeared to be influenced anyway. And I'm not talking about the movie's occasional explicit self-referential nods, like when our quartet of Ghostbusters post a video of their activities on YouTube, only to be shouted down by hordes of ignorant commenters. I should perhaps add here that if you count all the homages to the original, this remake, written by Feig and Katie Dippold, the self-referential nods count jumps from occasional to near constant. I'm talking about the whole structure of the story, though, here, Josh. Not long after our heroines have their first big busting success, a male skeptic shows up at their office and asks, "Why are you pretending to catch ghosts?" Allow me some wiggle room to rephrase slightly. He might as well have asked, Why are you women pretending to be Ghostbusters? There are real Ghostbusters, and their names are Peter, Ray, Egon, and Winston. You females are frauds. One of those females, Erin, is initially desperately ashamed by her past dalliance with the paranormal, and even after confirming the truth, is consumed with proving her legitimacy, a feeling shared perhaps by some cynical audience members looking for similar proof from the actress portraying Erin, Kristen Wiig. Not convinced, Josh? Who ultimately is the villain of the 1984 film? And don't you dare say or even think the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, or he'll appear in studio to destroy us. Gozer, of course, a.k.a. Gozer the Gozerian, Gozer the Destructor, Gozer the Traveler has come. I wanted to beat you to that. Who's the villain of the 2016 film? Slight spoiler here. Actor Neil Casey's Rowan North, a nerdy, misunderstood, rage-filled loner who exquisitely embodies the caricature of all the male trolls living in their mom's basements, determined to destroy, or make life miserable for anyway, Wiig & Co. Josh, did Ghostbusters' meta-ness help at all to justify its existence? Or is my theory merely an innocuous apparition?
Boy, is that a hopeful lens through which to view this movie.
I tried.
And I probably would have enjoyed it more if those things resonated with me a little bit more. I think they are resonating with some people. And in fact, I'll probably reference later on in this review somebody who took that lens and ran with it and really enjoyed the film.
Oh, really?
And I think it has some good points about it. But for me, the main issue with all of these references, whether they were intended, and I don't know that all of them are, because really, if you look at the plot of the original film, there was this thread of skepticism towards the ghost. It was there. So, yes.
Well, even Peter.
Yeah.
Bill Murray is skeptical.
Exactly. So, yes, it could be seen to apply to the current situation, but also it could just be a direct lift of the plot. I thought those elements, and more so the references to the original film, which you're dead on when you say are near constant, I thought they were cumbersome in a way that shackled these brilliant comic performers.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of letting them do their improvisational thing, as they certainly seem to do more in the earlier collaboration with Feig that McCarthy and Wiig did, Bridesmaids,
mm-hmm.
instead of giving them that room and that freedom and letting the comedy flow, this was like a list of chores they had to attend to.
Absolutely.
We have to visit Slimer. We have to have a reference to the firehouse. I mean, go on and on.
Let's throw Amy Potts in.
Oh, yeah. The cameos are just deadening.
Yeah.
Just deadening. And this restricts for two performers I'm very familiar with and I think are extremely talented in Wiig and McCarthy,
mm-hmm.
and two in McKinnon and Jones, who I don't know all that well, but based on this, certainly seem to hold a lot of promise. But here again, they're restricted by what this movie is asking them to do.
Right.
And maybe people are responding so well to McKinnon because she's the wild card here,
yeah.
right? She's not playing to the script. She's the one in the background doing something goofy because she doesn't necessarily have to attend to the plot as Wiig and McCarthy do. And so she gets to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? What an ingenious concept. Who else gets to be funny? Who's the funniest person in this movie?
You're not going to goad me as a guy to sit here and slam this movie and then praise the lone big male actor in the film, Josh. Sorry, I'm not going to do it.
He's so great. And again, it's not
good.
That Chris Hemsworth is more of a comedian than any of the four leads. It's the fact that he's given the chance and the environment to just be funny. His scenes as their dimbulb secretary, Kevin, are improvisational, they're loose, they don't attend to anything plot-wise, they just give him a chance to do something like hear a loud noise and instinctively rub his eyes instead of cover his ears.
Right.
Or tell a story about the name of his dog that meanders off into ridiculousness that had me laughing. Certainly, any of those actresses are capable of being funnier than that, but this movie rarely let them that opportunity.
Yeah, there's no doubt this movie has a mind-boggling and truly misguided reverence for the original movie. As we touched on, it's overloaded with homages and cameos. And I think it would have been tolerable if they were a little more clever, if they had been woven in without calling so much attention to themselves. I don't know if you even caught this one. This would be my example. At the beginning of the film, really, I think in the first scene or as the coda to the first scene, we meet Kristen Wiig's character. Okay, the first scene with her, she's not in the very beginning. And a character leaves her office at Columbia University where she's trying to be a tenured professor, and they just show in the hallway a bust, like an old bust like you'd see of Beethoven or Mozart
right.
or something. And it's Harold Ramis. So yes. that's a nice little touch, again, that doesn't really call all that much attention to itself. Otherwise, every time the movie pauses to work in one of those characters or one of those references, the movie really does pause. It comes to a screeching halt and delivers nothing. Bill Murray, I'll spoil it, he's in this film, if that's a spoiler. He was funnier, Josh, in Broken Flowers, the Jim Jarmusch film. That's a movie where he's more deadpan than Buster Keaton at a funeral. Dan Aykroyd appears. Isn't funny. And
so
Dan Aykroyd's
sad.
Almost always funny. The old logo appearing at one point, I could go on and on. They
the
treat these moments.
They go into contortions to work
exactly.
the old logo
As if we're all going to sit there and get giddy about it. And there's just nothing. There's nothing to them. We don't get misty-eyed with nostalgia. And we certainly don't laugh. I think this movie does exist in a sort of limbo where it's either trying to be its own film. It will add little spins like they don't get the firehouse. They tease us with the firehouse and instead they're on top of a Chinese restaurant. It gives us those moments. And then at other times, and of course it tries to cater clearly in instances to a younger audience that wouldn't know the 84 film or really care about it. It's either doing that or it's devoting massive amounts of energy to paying tribute to 1984.
Right.
And it's almost as if it's saying, don't be mad at us. Look at all these Easter eggs we're giving you. And by trying to do both, it doesn't succeed at either.
So Jurassic World, I think, for me at least, failed somewhat similarly in trying to conjure magic of the original and bring that into the current film. I think The Force Awakens is probably the best example of interweaving what came before into this new iteration.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the strategy for doing that, I think Ghostbusters is one of the worst I've seen. I still had a fair amount of fun during the movie. I think I liked it a little bit more than you did. Hemsworth was a big reason for it. McKinnon, I've already mentioned.
I thought he got a little tedious.
Well,
I just thought the redundancy of the gags
so
wore on
you're
me.
Bringing me back to a negative thing pretty quickly here, which is fair enough. But first I'll say also that I kind of enjoyed watching Wig and McCarthy play straight women, which you don't see them do much.
No,
and when
point.
They play off of Hemsworth, they were really good at it, and it was kind of a different variation of their comic skills. So I thought that they were effective and even managed to bring some substance to the relationship between those two characters, okay? Maybe just enough for a movie like this. They did some acting, okay?
Yes, they
did a little bit
of
acting.
They're good.
And they're convincing, yes. So yeah, what you were talking about in terms of Hemsworth wearing out his welcome, well, that's because they bring Kevin back and work him into this climax that is yet another siege on a city. And I know there was some element
and
of this.
Not even a well-choreographed one.
I
mean,
no.
Almost out of Plan 9 from Outer Space, except if Ed Wood had CGI at his disposal.
Yes.
That's what it felt like.
That is fair. And I know the original film had a big apocalyptic ending like this. But here, because of Hemsworth's presence, this read like another Avengers finale in that you're battling hordes of computer-generated thingies that nobody really cares about. Here they're
even
ghosts.
Less stakes, right?
Yeah, completely. And yeah, and at that point when Hemsworth is there, you're like, okay, you've pushed this too far. Let's not even get into the post-credits dance sequence, which at that point, you're just
or
completely
the very coda at the end of the film is just ridiculous. I mean, it's this stupid moment at the end of the credits that the movie doesn't earn in any way. I think it's pretty clear this movie is conceptually broken, and we've touched on one of the big reasons why. It's because of that reverence for the original film. It certainly isn't because they cast four women as Ghostbusters. That is truly the only reason to justify this film at all. I remember when, before the trailer, when this was initially announced, I was actually pretty excited about it because I certainly wasn't calling for or begging for a new Ghostbusters movie. But I thought if you're going to do it, if you're going to put a spin on it, get four really talented women in those roles.
Sure.
And then on top of it, you said it, Wig and McCarthy, we already know, are pretty great. But most of the world doesn't know how good Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones are. Now, Leslie Jones is even branching out into commercials, maybe because of Ghostbusters. I don't know. But you see her on commercials. She's a little bit more visible. I still watch Saturday Night Live pretty regularly, so I know how brilliant Kate McKinnon is. But I don't think, obviously, most people going to this movie do. And they'll have some sense of how funny she is when they see this film.
Yeah, I think she'll be a standout star from this movie.
Like Hemsworth, though, I have seen some people online, on Twitter and other places, praising her to the hilt. And look, I think she's probably the brightest spot in this film, actually, for me. But she's still stuck in this movie. So the notion that she's hilarious, I mean, she just wasn't for me at all. There weren't enough redeeming moments. But that's why you make this movie. That's the concept that works, or the part of the concept that works. But it doesn't really do anything interesting, and I'm curious what you think about this, with the gender reversal. And we may not be the right people to weigh in on that. Maybe someone out there has written about this and articulates something I missed. I'd be curious. Go ahead and send in those links. But besides the Hemsworth stuff that works okay, putting him as kind of the himbo, the secretary who's there really just because of his looks, there's nothing unique about the material. Bridesmaids, to go back to Feig's kind of breakout movie, that was this raunchy comedy that was tethered by how it explored the dynamics of female friendships. And Ghostbusters actually starts out fairly strong in this regard. We get the backstory between Abby and Aaron, McCarthy and Wig. Mm-hmm. And then it almost completely abandons it, only to try and work it back in just in time to give the ending a little emotional weight. But there isn't any. It's too late. And there's a lot of reasons why it doesn't work, some of the ones we touched on. But this movie is just so poorly constructed that I love seeing all these hipster critics out there who are deriding the original film. That's okay. But this mess makes Reitman's movie, I think, Hitchcockian by comparison. That's how tightly constructed the 84 is by comparison. The other way that they're limited, you talked about how because of the way this movie is made and because of those cumbersome homages to the original film, these actresses are limited. I think they're also really limited by the fact that the movie's PG-13. You look at Spy, you look at Bridesmaids, Feig's two previous really good films. They're not just R's. They're pretty hard R's, right? And anything really daring or edgy that could have been in this movie, and who knows, maybe they improvised, has obviously been cut out or sanitized in some way. Everybody here felt to me like they were being held back. So you get a lot of really lame tags to scenes, these random comments that really are random. They feel like throwaway lines at the end of, appropriately, an SNL skit where they add nothing. They certainly aren't funny. People are already clapping usually at the end of these scenes. They're just a way out of the scene. This whole film is constructed on ways out of scenes, and that's not compelling. And you mentioned, I mean, let's talk about appealing to those kids. The fact that Slimer is even in this movie, and I guess
way too much screen time.
He has a wife or a family or something. And you know what?
I think that was just a hot date. There were some kids
sitting in front of us at the screening we went to, and they seemed to enjoy it. I hope it makes kids giggle. I hope it helps them move some products. And that's another thing about this film, the product placement. I was starving for Papa John's after this film. That's the biggest impact this movie had on me. So there are just a lot of problems with this movie.
Well, that's a good question that you ask. Do they do enough with the fact that they did cast four women in the leads? And you touched on one thing with the villain and how he represents the internet trolls. And I thought he was pretty good, actually.
Yeah,
Neil Casey in the role. He amused me quite a bit. That is one thing that this is who I wanted to bring up. That's something that Wendy Fox Weber, who you know, my former editor, she's now works with the Tribune Papers.
I saw that four-star review on Letterboxd.
She went nuts for
four
the
out of five. I didn't
read
it, though.
Well, so. I linked to it. I actually, the Why I'm Wrong page that I have on my site, she was fired it off to me right away. It's like, this is going back on there because
she
you did not appreciate
this. She probably
won't
talk to me after she looks at my star rating.
You're pretty harsh. I mean, this is going to be a rift between you. Anyway, she really clued in on what she found to be the subversive feminist qualities of it. One was the villain that you mentioned.
Okay.
And the other was, I'll let you, you can go and read to all of them. The one thing that
we'll
I think was really,
yeah,
the one
too.
Thing I think that was really interesting that did not occur to me at all, but I think is dead on, and I wish I had thought of it this way while watching it, is Kate McKinnon in that climactic battle. I'm going to just quote what Wendy wrote because it's an interesting, it's
please
an interesting
don't tell
take
me,
here.
Please don't tell me it's the part that your wife Debbie enjoyed.
Yeah, she liked it too.
Oh,
she
no.
liked it too. All right. This is what Wendy says. There's a scene in Ghostbusters where Kate McKinnon, dressed in a loose jumpsuit, fights a bunch of ghosts in a way that can only be described as badass. In slow motion, McKinnon runs and makes a bunch of ghosts sorry they ever came back to New York. It was at this point that I realized I'd never seen a woman in a scene quite like this one. The only one I could think of was a highly sexualized Carrie Ann Moss in The Matrix, but her costume was so tight she may as well have been naked. Parentheses, she was also very badass and I love her. Honestly, I got a little misty in the McKinnon scene. It was just so unique.
Okay.
I, you know,
Isn't
I can
Thurman
see that
highly sexualized in that jumpsuit in the Kill Bill movies as the bride?
I think people might make that argument.
I don't feel like there is no doubt Carrie Ann Moss is wearing really tight leather outfits, but I don't feel like she's highly sexualized in that role.
I think there are probably examples. It's safe to say this is the baggiest outfit action heroine has ever worn.
I'll grant you that.
Let's just say there's a point here that I think, and I think if you take that lens you started with in your intro and really want to view the film through it, that there's enough material to justify that. There's a big question of how much of it is intentional and how much of it is just, as I said, born out of what was in the original film, and how much of it are you bringing to the movie and really wanting it to be this?
That's what that feels like to me because, and this might be my problem, I'm too tethered to the script and the story and what I felt was lacking there. This perfectly dovetails into another issue I had with the movie, a very specific moment I thought that needed to be there. This film hits so many beats with slight variations from the original film, like the rock concert, for example, where they capture their first ghost, which is the same basic thing that unfolds when they go to the hotel, right, in the 1984 version. But despite all that adherence to the structure of the first movie, it never gives us, inexplicably, the cleaning up the town montage, right, where we see the Ghostbusters after that first capture and all hell breaks loose and they actually get good at their jobs. We never get that. It literally goes from first capture to all hell breaking loose. We never see them grow into these roles. These are scientists. These are not people who, despite her ability to create fancy, weird weapons, she doesn't know how to do Carrie Ann Moss Trinity-like moves. And yet at the end of the film, she does. And they even know how to shoot their guns as well as they do. We needed...
So you're telling me that Carrie Ann Moss sequence was just not believable enough for you?
Yeah, I kind of am because, I mean, you can laugh at it, but what I'm saying is the story needed to show us that they actually developed some proficiency as Ghostbusters.
There are huge holes.
And it's not there. And that just makes you able to tune out even more as this film is going on because you know that there's nothing holding any of it together. There are no stakes at all to any part of this film.
And it certainly could, even taking this reading and latching on to those elements and saying, you could look at it this way and it is subversively feminist. There's certainly more they could have done with this proposal of casting four women in the lead to make that more entertaining. I don't mean that it had to be more blatant, but to wring more humor out of it and to use that as a guiding principle. I don't think the casting of the four women was a guiding principle for this film. I think it was, you know, not surprisingly, to make a lot of money, of course. But beyond that, I don't know that it knew what its guiding principle was.
In terms of how
much do we honor the original? How much do we do our own thing? Mm-hmm. How much do we... It's kind of a lost hodgepodge of all those things.
And there is, in fact, I'm sorry to keep harping on this, but there's a whole section of this film that very clearly was cut from it. And it's at the point, and it's bad when you can see in the movie where the editor's in and out point were. But it's quite clearly here in this film where they get arrested. Slight spoilers again. They get arrested.
Yeah.
It goes from them getting arrested. We don't even see them in jail. They're just arrested. The next scene, all of a sudden, Kristen Wiig is back in her apartment in civilian clothes. And it goes right from that to she discovers how all this apocalypse is going to go down. So you watch how the rest of it plays out, and there are certain lines that make no sense because they lost the part. At one point, Kate McKinnon's character says, "Welcome back," as if she left the Ghostbusters because she was finally so fed up with being fraudulent, not being taken seriously. That's in the script. They clearly shot it, maybe edited it in the first cut, and then said, well, this is all too long or whatever. And maybe it's a better movie without it. I'm just saying it's blatantly it's obvious that there are whole lines and sections of this movie that don't make sense because they just started chopping it up.
There is a shabbiness to it as well.
Yeah.
There's no denying that.
Okay. Shabby. That's how we're describing Ghostbusters 2016. If Bustin' makes you feel good, though, you're in luck. Ghostbusters is, of course, out in wide release. I didn't check the box office, but my son informed me that it neither did terribly or
I think second place, right?
Okay.
After the Secret Life of Pets, I think that one.
I go to my 14-year-old son for all my box office news. It's obviously doing very well for me. If you see Ghostbusters or have seen it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. And I encourage everyone out there, if you somehow are interested in more Ghostbusters talk, at least one for sure, semi-positive take on the film. Matt Singer, along with Matt Allison Wilmore. Well, I know he gave it 3 stars.
Okay, and that's positive.
And when I casually mentioned to him how terrible I thought it was, he said, oh, come on, it's not that bad. So we had a slightly different experience, but Matt and Allison discuss Ghostbusters 2016 on their latest edition of Film Spotting SVU. They also talk about the great William Friedkin movie Sorcerer, and they share some other picks for dangerous job movies that are available via streaming or on demand. What happens in Sorcerer? A whole lot more dangerous than anything we see in Ghostbusters 2016.
With you, you'll no longer be yourself.
I remember everything.
Strangely, Jason Bourne has no memory of Jeremy Renner. I'm taking all the chems I can, Josh, to try to wipe my memory clean of that movie. Alas, it's not working. But Matt Damon, they're back in the role of Jason Bourne. And that bit of the trailer for Jason Bourne, which reunites Damon with director Paul Greengrass, it's the movie we were planning to review on next week's show. Obviously, opens on the 29th. We were going to get to the advanced screening. I'm very excited to see it. I love all the previous Bourne films, minus that Renner movie. But it looks like we might have a change in plans. There's a movie that a lot of people have been commenting on would be a perfect fit for a Golden Brick nominee, The Fitz, also opening on July 29th. We might get to that instead.
I would like to do that, though I'm also a Bourne fan. And
you are.
I even like Legacy. Sorry.
Really?
I'm kind of like just, you know, boringly
it's not an
in favor of
but
all of them. I think on my site they're all like 3 out of 4 stars. You know,
okay.
I think they're a lot of fun.
See, I feel way more passionately.
You're
about
really high
the first
on the,
three,
yeah,
really,
and a lot of people are. So I'm excited about a new one.
Okay, so you are kind of looking forward to this,
and
one,
I'll
though.
Go see it. Yeah, Debbie's a huge fan, so she wants me to take her. So I'll be seeing it no matter.
Why
what.
Is Debbie a huge fan?
I think it's the velocity of Matt Damon's punches.
Yeah,
specifically.
I think that works for me too. The real question here is, will you get to talk about drones? Because I know that's the key.
Is that part of the plot?
I don't know. We will have to.
I can't wait.
We will have to find out. Speaking of finding out, on our next show, you'll find out the results of our latest poll question. We asked you last week in a very convoluted, drawn-out way, and ultimately to no surprise whatsoever when you look at the results, we asked you which director won the 2000s. So the criteria that Sam came up with was basically a director who had consistent critical and box office success. He made his debut or made her debut in the 2000s or had his or her best decade in the 2000s. And yeah, the current leader, we could have predicted this. There's just a lot of love for directors who make superhero movies. And that's fine. It's a good choice. It's
well,
a good choice.
It was choice. My choice. It was a choice I made.
I take that back. It's an average choice. Speaking of bad choices, you would think in our advanced age, we would have learned this simple life lesson by now, which is don't count your chickens before they hatch.
Or don't announce a live show before you have a venue is
you,
the other
you
variation.
Could go that way.
That's the other variation of that phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the variation that applies to us because some, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks ago, we came here, we sat on these mics and we said
very confidently
that we knew we were going to find the perfect venue. We had plenty of time. And we were going to have a live show for our 600th episode on August 27th. Again, no tickets to announce, nothing on sale. We didn't even have the venue, but we were extremely confident. And, well, it didn't transpire.
Well, we have sort of a good reason for that. There's a couple of reasons.
There are.
Venues were getting hard to find. Time was running out.
Venues that met our requirements were getting hard to find. And there's also something I'm not ready to announce, because I've learned this lesson, that may be coming later in November that could be even bigger. We could be part of something bigger, but that would still involve the three podcasts that are part of the Film Spotting family of shows: Next Picture Show, SVU, and of course, as Matt calls it, Original Recipe, Film Spotting.
And we wouldn't have been able to do an August show and this potential show.
No, we really couldn't have pulled that off. And hey, if we destroyed your summer by making you book a ticket to Chicago, like I know one listener did, coming from Austin to Chicago.
What was his name again?
Richard.
Sorry, Richard, we're so sorry.
He couldn't wait anymore for us to come to Austin, so he just said, I'll come to Chicago. I'll go to them. And what do? We don't give him a show. So instead, you have earned a private screening with Josh, a dream date with Josh. He will take you out. He'll show you the sights of Chicago. It'll be wonderful. It'll be just like a live show.
Funnily enough, I have August 27 is open for me.
Yeah.
So that'll work fine, Richard.
Good. And you know what? I'm going to keep it open for me, too, because I feel like we're going to have some apologies here to hand out and maybe some make goods to follow through on. So, yeah, if we ruin your plans, if you already booked a ticket, we apologize. We'll try to make it up to you one way or another. Last week on the show, the esteemed Michael Phillips dropped by, and that was a fun show. I love the fact that we had some unique picks there spread out among the 15 choices ultimately that made our top five.
Pretty nice variety.
13 different films there made the list. The only overlap is I had a film in common with Michael. That was Krisha. And Josh, you had one film in common with him. That was The Witch, which we'll get to some thoughts on here in a minute, because we don't do a whole lot of listener feedback here on the show anymore. I'd like to include a little bit more of it. And we thought we got some really good responses to the best of 2016 so far. Why not include them, like this one from Jonathan in New Orleans? I love where he came out on this one, Josh.
If I'm being totally honest, I don't have a clear-cut favorite of 2016 so far, as three movies are battling it out in my head for captivating me in different ways. But since I suspect The Lobster and Swiss Army Man are likely to be discussed by others, I'm here to make my case for Sing Street. You're number one, right, Adam?
Mm-hmm.
It's a film just brimming with optimism that kept me smiling from ear to ear for essentially its entire runtime. The songs were all infectious, and I immediately bought the soundtrack off iTunes once the lights came up and listened to it on my bike ride home. Perhaps it just hit me at the right time. I'm a recent college graduate who had only a couple weeks earlier quit my steady restaurant management job to more actively pursue a career in film and theater. So seeing John Carney's film about the role of art in shaping our identities and expressing ourselves to pursue our passions was especially comforting for me in a time of uncertainty to just grab the wheel and own it and drive it like I stole it.
Love it. Jonathan actually sent that in before we recorded that show, before he obviously heard it, and we are in lockstep on that John Carney film. This note from the world's biggest film nerd, financial representative, Stefan. I'm going with Stefan, S-T-E-P-H-A-N. Boxy.
That's how the financial representatives pronounce it.
I'm sure they do. Stefan says, hey, love the show, best film of the year, and I'm shocked if it will change, is Knight of Cups.
Ooh, Stefan.
This film is the culmination of everything Malick has been building up to. No, that was the Tree of Life, Stefan. I know you both were lukewarm on the film, but I think this is so successful as a meditation on current culture. Clearly, all things modern to Malick is foreign, but Malick shows he is not the hermit that his legend portrays him to be. This film is insightful and personal, like all Malick films. Lastly, this is not Malick repeating himself aesthetically, like so many critics have said. Nothing in 2016 will look like this film, and no film has before. A mixture of different filming techniques and formats and an even more experimental editing style, this makes all other Malick films seem plot-heavy and linear. Okay, last thing for real. This makes a great pairing for my second favorite film of 2016, Hail Caesar. Man, Hail Caesar, I know they're both set in Hollywood. Let's go with that. But that movie is certainly a romp. Compared to, you might need that romp after seeing Knight of Cups.
I'm glad he threw Hail Caesar in there at the end to save himself. We also heard from Christopher Reese in Lexington, Kentucky. Very happy to hear the sonorous, rich tones of Michael Phillips adding to the mix. It should not be surprising that Michael is the one who places The Witch in the correct position on this list. For me, this is easily the best film of the year so far. When I saw it twice back-to-back weekends in the theater, it was the most engrossing and visceral experience that I had had in a theater in a long, long time. And then after that, the film continues to stick with me in the best of ways. I suppose I can understand the issues that people have with the ending of this film. I guess I just do not share them. Indeed, it feels to me like the only way in which this particular story can end. A truly original and powerful piece of work.
So we touched on this when we were listing our picks, but real quick, Knight of Cups, I'm not sure when that might be released. I don't think right now you can see that unless it's still lingering in any theaters around the country. But Sing Street out on DVD and other platforms here July 26th, and The Witch already out on DVD, yes. Available on demand as well. Though, like I said, I recommend getting the DVD or getting it from iTunes, where at least usually they allow you to turn on the subtitles. That might have made it a little bit more pleasant of an experience for me. We close with Khalid in Rawalpindi, Pakistan. I just started listening to your show, and I must say I've quickly become a huge fan. My favorite film of the year is kind of a tie between Green Room and Son of Saul, which came out in 2016 here. And I was just about to say, Josh, that Son of Saul was a movie unseen by both of us still, but you did catch up with it, didn't you?
I didn't see it until January.
Yeah.
But I will say if I had seen it earlier, because it got a New York and LA release in 2015, it would have been in my top 10.
Yeah.
It's just harrowing and riveting.
Yeah. I still haven't been able to build up the strength to see it. Khalid goes on, both films are genre films that do groundbreaking things for their respective genres, and their rock hard essence has lingered in my mind for weeks. Definitely can recommend Green Room. I'm not sure about where that film stands in its release, but has to be coming out fairly soon for rental. Thanks to everyone who sent in some feedback. Wish we could get to more, but we have to get to Massacre Theater.
It's the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. A couple weeks back, Adam and guest host Melissa Taminga massacred this scene.
I have come to take you back to Fort Smith.
Well, I will not go. How do you like that?
But there's a posse of officers up there who will force you to go.
Well, that is interesting news. And how many is up there?
Right around 50. And they're all well-armed and they mean business. What I want you to do now is come on across the creek and walk in front of me up that hill.
I think I will oblige the officers to come after me.
But if you refuse to go, I will have to shoot you.
Oh. Well, then you had better cock your piece. All the way back. Don't lock.
I know how to do it. You will not go with me?
No, it's just the other way around. You're going with me.
That was Josh Brolin as Tom Chaney and Haley Steinfeld as Maddie Ross in 2010's True Grit. Written, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen, adapted from the novel by Charles Portis.
That massacre, part of my show with Melissa filling in for you, Josh. We reviewed Swiss Army Man and talked about the passing of the legendary Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami with Tina Hassania. We also shared our top five body movies, and we heard from Andre Cadeau in Charlottesville, Virginia, longtime listener who said the most recent Massacre Theater was from True Grit. While I commend your voice work, Adam, I think you would have sounded more like Tom Chaney had you hit yourself in the head with a blunt instrument or had half a dozen shots of tequila beforehand. I usually only do three or four.
Yeah, that's,
I think the extra couple would have put me over the top, Josh.
Andre's close to your pre-show ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, aside from bringing excellent thoughts and being an enjoyable listen, Melissa, I think, brought out one of your best Massacre Theater performances.
Well, thank you.
I really think you did a great
Chaney. She did a good job as Haley.
And something about she just, you know, the interaction and...
A lot of people were ripping on me for that Tom Chaney.
I liked
it. My attempt at a Southern accent. I didn't know I was trying a Southern accent. I was just trying to sound like Josh Brolin in that scene. And he does sound like someone who's been hit in the head with a blunt instrument. That wasn't that hard for me to pull off.
I've found that ignorance to what you're trying to do is the key to Massacre Theater performances.
That's so revealing about your process.
We also heard from Tom Robertson from Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. This week's Massacre Theater was a scene from the Coen Brothers film True Grit. Possible connections include the isolated settings of both True Grit and Swiss Army Man and the behind-the-camera dual directing talents in both films, Joel and Ethan for Grit and the Daniels for Swiss Army.
So we totally didn't think of either of those. At least I didn't, but a perfect connection there in terms of being outdoors and the fact that we've got a duo behind the lens, but we were going so much more simple.
Yeah, what was
than that?
The
well, David in Chicago
connection.
Got it. For me, the dead giveaway, as it were, was a telltale lack of contractions, pointing me to the great True Grit, in which the action starts with young Maddie recovering her father's corpse before seeking a man with the titular quality to avenge him.
Ah, yes.
It all starts with a
makes
body.
Sense.
All starts with a body. That's where we were going. Thank you to everyone who entered. Josh, the film spotting hat, despite my take on Tom Chaney, not brimming. You have a lot of room there to feel around and pick out this week's winner.
Winner is Mason Bailey from Lexington, Kentucky.
Congratulations, Mason. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we will set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
I don't know what to do here with this week's edition of Massacre Theater. There's no straight man for me to play.
No.
This is going to be hard, but you definitely have the taller task.
This is a challenge.
Yeah.
If I do it right, it should be easy for people to identify.
Yeah, this guy makes it look easy.
Yeah, there's a very small chance of that happening.
Okay, I started off, you're going to give me the action.
And action.
1 minute, I'm on the 14th hole at Wingfoot, lining up a putt. A heart attack later, I'm a worm feast.
No. You're not a worm feast. You're a hallucination brought on by alcohol, Russian vodka poisoned by Chernobyl. I've been under a lot of pressure lately.
Silence!
Ouch!
I had it all. I was a captain of industry, feared by men, adored by women.
Adored? Let's be honest, Lou. You paid for the women.
And scene. Let's hear that
close,
adored
close
one
all?
More time, Josh.
I gotta work up to it. You'll get it at an unexpected
well,
moment.
Well, we could redo it.
No.
We could do another take.
Are you implying I didn't nail it?
Close. Do you know how many times I've wanted to just go, silence?
Yes, I believe it. I know why
response
you,
to
I know why you really
said.
Picked that part.
Yeah, I mean, that was cathartic for me, actually. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. You've got 2 weeks to enter. Deadline is Monday, August 1st.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net. Is that better?
A little. Just a little.
Jeg savner dig.
Lad være med det der.
Det må være svært for Elias, at hans far er væk så meget.
Rejser så meget.
Hej far.
Har vi sagt, at vi skulle ringe i dag, eller?
Jeg fik bare lyst til at tale med dig.
Det her, det er Christian. Christian har lige flyttet til fra London.
Mor, din mor, hun er død. Hun har kræft.
Our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon takes an abrupt turn this week, Adam, at least in terms of tone. There's no more droll humor, so much for abstract narratives, far less tubas. We've moved from the deadpan comedy of Aki Kaurismäki and Roy Anderson to an Oscar-friendly melodrama. Indeed, Danish director Susanne Bier's In a Better World won the 2011 Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. The story involves a Danish surgeon, played by Michael Persbrandt, who tries to solve the world's problems by occasionally flying off to war-torn corner of Africa to provide care at a refugee camp. In the meantime, he's absent for much of the strife occurring in his own home, particularly the nervousness of his 10-year-old son, Elias, played by Marcus Rygaard, who's being mercilessly bullied at school. Help for Elias appears to come from Christian, played by William Nielsen, a new boy at school who's coping with the recent death of his mother by becoming a pint-sized vigilante. After standing up for Elias, the two boys become fast friends. In a Better World becomes then a meditation on the intractable nature of violence, both at home and in the larger world. But not everyone was as impressed by the movie as Oscar voters. When I logged a review on Letterboxd, Jacob Hinchley, who lives in Denmark and knows Beer's work better than I do, responded to say he found the film to be heavy-handed, too obvious, unintentionally funny, and inauthentic. Did any of these words capture your experience, Adam, or do you think the Oscar for In a Better World was well-deserved?
Well, I'm still honestly trying to determine where I exactly fall on this movie. I was going to ask you, how long have you been doing film criticism, Josh?
Do
you remember when you started
like
professionally?
Before I first published something and got paid for it.
Okay, so over 20 years. What percentage of the time would you say you had a very clear path in mind, and then as you were writing your review, you took a real turn? Like, didn't just slightly downgrade it or slightly upgraded it, but were like, actually, okay, I didn't like that movie, or I did like it.
I would say more often I will like something more as I'm writing about it. Not very often does it happen where I'll start processing it and be like, oh, there's nothing here.
Okay. Well, it's more the opposite for me with this film. And that probably makes sense because it's a movie that I think probably does try to hit you on a gut emotional level. And in the moment, I was really with a lot of this film and really cared about these characters and the story. And the more I dissected it a little bit, the more inauthentic I thought it felt. I might actually just be a little angry that it beat out Dogtooth for the
Best Foreign Language
Oscar.
You never want to look at how that went down because it's usually not well.
Yeah, you're right. So I'm trying to figure it out because I do feel like I liked this movie, but the more I did think about it and the more I wrote down my notes, the more I realized that I was kind of talking myself out of it. So we'll see where we fall by the end of the review. There's no doubt on the plus side that the cinematographer, Morten Søborg, and Beer, they have a great eye, right?
Yeah.
Together.
You know it right away.
Yeah. The color, the composition, it's very painterly. It's gorgeous. Reminded me in some ways of Sunset Song, the Terrence Davies film that we talked about a few weeks ago. I wouldn't call it ostentatious or too ostentatious. And the camera movement itself certainly isn't distracting. There were occasions where the compositions were so fastidious that I did catch myself paying more attention to the framing and to the color and how things were foregrounded than the characters or the emotions. But overall, I'd say that was a strength of the film. The biggest thing I did enjoy about this film, and I say that and I'm going to set it up with a negative, from a dramatic standpoint, there are no real surprises here. It telegraphs exactly where it's going. I think we know exactly how it's going to play out. It's mostly a matter of when, not if, with any of the scenarios we see. And it's a little bit funny that these people just can't escape bullies, right? No matter where they go, which I get it, is probably kind of the point of the movie. That's how the world is. It's all about the powerful exploiting the powerless. Still, it seems maybe a little bit too coincidental in some instances. But what I like, Josh, is the way Beer doesn't seem to be in a rush to get to those quote-unquote heavy moments. It didn't feel to me that it was about manipulation, where she's trying to manipulate us into feeling a certain way or to learn something grand by the end of the film. But mostly she's focused on capturing genuine human moments. This is a movie about people trying to connect with each other or trying to reconnect with each other and the difficulty of that, whether it's because of past experience or past traumas or just our frailties as human beings. I think she really does tap into that. I think she's an empathic director, and that really comes through. The key scene for me that kind of encapsulates that is a phone conversation that happens between Anton and his estranged wife. You're nodding. Is this something you noted as well?
It's an excellent scene.
Okay,
yeah.
So there's a chat they have on the phone. That's
right.
All
yeah.
It is. And we've obviously been introduced to both these characters. We've learned that they have been separated. He's always off in Africa, as you pointed out, and it's taken a toll on their marriage. We learned that maybe some other activity on his part took a toll on the marriage as well. And this conversation they have, it serves no plot function whatsoever. It really doesn't set anything up that we need to know or will need to know. It just serves us seeing who these two people are and them realizing that they may be a little lost and they're confused and they're hurt, but they need each other, or at least they think they need something from each other, and they can't let this connection go. And there are enough moments like that that at least before I started to tear this movie apart, I felt like this was an experience I definitely would recommend.
Yeah, the wife of the surgeon is played by Trin Dearholm, and she is excellent. I think the performances across the board are excellent, especially by the two child actors. That's where
I
rooted my sort of emotional focus and what carried me through any melodrama that this movie fully embraces by its end. There are two plot twists that I think, you know, really raise things to too high of a volume level.
Maybe.
That's not necessary. But because those kids were involved and their experiences seem so real, it carried me through it.
Can we talk about those performances
for
a second? Because it gets back to that Letterboxd comment you read where a Danish person commented on how he didn't like the performances at all. And I think you responded to that. And then he said, well, maybe it's because I'm Danish and I understand them. This goes back to something I've brought up for years on this show when we're watching marathons, where it's very difficult, I feel, sometimes to truly know what you think of a performance when you're watching people speak another language, right? I mean, it all feels new to us because we don't move our mouths that way. And so it's just very hard to someone speaking English, what we would consider as nuanced in a performance.
Right.
We don't know what the nuances are.
We don't.
And maybe he's saying there's no nuance because he knows what they're saying. But I felt
his, right. I think his complaint was with the words that they were actually speaking, which is one thing, the screenplay, and then also how they were actually forming those words and delivering them. Those are two things we can't access.
Right.
Okay. So that could be, you know, a very fair criticism. What I could access and what came through to me, though, first of all, with Nielsen, who plays the new friend, Christian, just really harrowing how he's this good-looking, seemingly polite kid, yet all the time you see roiling underneath that face, this fresh face, is this anger and resentment. And some of it is tied to the fact that his mother has just died. Some of it is tied to the fact that his relationship with his father is all a mess, partly because of that. And this kid manages to let us see that right under the surface. Even better is Rygaard as Elias.
I agree.
I mean, this kid is so heartbreaking. He's nervously blinking a lot.
It's that smile, though.
And
that smile when he sees Christian and realizes he might have a kindred spirit.
Yes.
And that kid even looks at him.
He gives a variation on that to everyone because he's such an easy-to-please kid. And what is that, you know, just in the way boyhood society works, that almost marks him as a victim.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very Lord of the Flies quality to this film that Beer gets really well that, again, carried me through all the other things people might have complaints about, because you get this sense that so Elias's father at one point tries to take the high road and gets bullied at a park by another father when there's a misunderstanding with their kids. And the other father,
they just can't escape those bullies.
Right, right. Yeah,
everywhere they go.
Yeah, it's thematically heavy. And he kind of walks away, even though he's slapped by this guy. And of course, Christian, the vigilante, is like, why don't you go after him?
Mm-hmm.
And he's teasing Elias, like, why doesn't your father do something? So the father takes them later, a few days later, to meet this bully and wants to prove to them that, A, he's not afraid and that violence isn't the answer. And it's such – this is why I don't find this film heavy-handed, is because that's such a complicated scene, because in a way he makes his point. But at the same time, Beer gives the moment where Christian is in the background saying to Elias, like, your dad's a total wuss.
Right.
And the kids understand it's all well and good for the adults to say that violence is not the answer, but we're in the trenches.
Right.
You know, we got to go to recess. They don't have to go to recess.
Totally.
And here's also where I think the parallel with the Africa scenes, which could be very problematic. I mean, on paper, this sounds like a terrible movie.
They are problematic, Josh.
Okay. Let me offer a defense for them. So Anton, as this surgeon, eventually runs into this warlord who he's been helping the women who have come from this village that the warlord is cutting up, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it's really horrific. So again, another bully, like real world, big time bully. Okay.
Yeah.
What I like about that is that he initially tries his pacifism approach. Then he abandons it, not to give too much away, except just to say to you, as someone who's seen it, think about the fate of that warlord,
I agree.
The ultimate faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really complicated. I don't think the movie is saying that, you know, you should just turn the other cheek and that'll solve all our problems. I don't think it's saying that revenge will solve all our problems. I think it's saying that this is a colossal mess.
Right.
And here are some average people trying to figure their way through it.
Yeah.
I found that compelling.
No, I'm with you. And that is the experience I definitely had while watching it. Real quick, a couple more positives before we get to some of the negatives. There's a moment, and here I'm outing myself even more as an ugly American, I certainly didn't tap into until a character brought it up. But the way Beer draws attention to all the different things that keep us apart and keep us from connecting as people, when the father Anton brings the kids to that garage to confront the bully, he's not around, and so he has to ask for him and asks this woman working there. And at first she acts like, who are you asking for? I don't recognize that name. It's Lars. And she repeats back to him like, Lars? And she's actually making fun of him, because what we learn is they're Swedish,
right,
not Danish.
Yeah.
So they're not saying the name properly. And that's immediately a way for them to separate from each other, or her to see a distinction and to see him as the other that she doesn't like. So there are lots of touches like that. And one total aside here, but I want to say it because I don't think you saw it. There's a movie that came out earlier this year that I did see and recommend, though didn't love, the latest from Joachim Trier, Louder Than Bombs, that really did help me, I think, get on the same wavelength with this movie, because they're very similar.
Okay.
It's a similar tale. It's a little more experimental in its structure in terms of the narrative, where we get a little bit of a Rashomon effect and different perspectives on different things, but it's ultimately the story of a mother who has died and a son who is not dealing with that well at all and who is really disconnected from his father, played by Gabriel Byrne. So there's a lot of behavior in that movie that I found really hard to watch as a parent and found myself really hoping that I'm never that disconnected from any of my kids and kind of for a little bit not really believing it in a way. Like, that's the wrong way to put it. But I mean, that fear of not being able to connect on any level, no matter how reasonable you're trying to be. And we see that a lot in Louder Than Bombs. We certainly see it a lot here with Christian and his father in this movie. You mentioned the performance of Christian. I'm with you on the performance overall. I'll throw in, though, that I thought he was quite good, especially in a lot of the emotional scenes. But he does also come off sometimes as not just troubled, but disturbed, bordering on sociopathic.
Like, well, and that's what Elias's mother accuses him of at one point, right?
And we understand that. I mean, there's a little bit of a Damien quality to this kid, which I suppose works. It makes him a little more sinister and compelling. But at the same time, it also makes his eventual arc, I think, feel a little bit false because it's hard to buy. But when I talk about how the more I think about this film, the harder time I had with it, it's just, it does feel kind of like that stereotypical Best Picture winner, right?
Yes,
even though it's the best foreign language film, where it's important with a capital I. And it's total wish fulfillment in so many ways. This idea that Beer ultimately espouses that love and communication will transcend all. But really, if you think about it, if you break down the film, love and communication plus a tragedy that miraculously doesn't kill or maim anyone will transcend all. There's a lot of luck that ends up factoring into that here. If that tragedy, which I'll just dance around and say there is a big moment, I think we all see it coming from the moment the idea is introduced. If that goes a different way and a character ends up in a different predicament than he does, these parents are not having all their problems solved. They're not coming together and healing at all the way they do ultimately in this film.
Fair enough. I don't know that all the problems are solved, though. I think emotionally it wants to bring us there, and maybe that is a fault of the film, but I think there is a lot of ambiguity on the sidelines, specifically in relation to where things are left in Africa. And it, to me, it complicated things just enough to make this under the surface more interesting than it at first appears. Because it does at first appear like that Oscar logo movie. I'll give you that.
It does. So let's go ahead and get into the Africa stuff a little bit, because we heard just today from Josh Youngerman in Brooklyn, a longtime listener of the show. We talk about movies a lot. I knew he hated this movie for some reason, and we talked about it a little bit. And he sent in this email. He said, "Sometimes all it takes is a misplaced subplot to ruin a perfectly good film. This is the case with In a Better World. Had Beer stuck with the main storyline involving the friendship of two outsider kids who hatch a plot of revenge, it would have been a good movie. The fact that Beer shoehorns in a subplot about one of the boys' dads going over to an unnamed country in Africa, ravaged by genocide, to tend to their medical needs completely sinks the movie. In the end, those scenes in Africa take up 50% of the film's running time. I'm not sure his math is correct, but he might be close. And the imagery of the wounds of the African people becomes exploitative. The scenes in Denmark are effective enough, but the African plot is misguided. For a long time, films have been obsessed with showing the plight of African genocide on screen while telling it through a standard Hollywood narrative. Films like The Last King of Scotland, Blood Diamond, and even the unsuccessful Hotel Rwanda can be excused because those stories take place in Africa. This can't be excused because the film isn't even really set in Africa. It's unfortunate because there is a good film buried in here, and because of the exploitative footage in Africa, we do not get that. We don't need another movie about the white man coming in and saving Africa. It's funny because the African country in the film is unnamed, and that is exactly how it feels, because the Africans are never given a voice. They are just anonymous victims." So, well before I heard from Josh on this, really from the opening frame of the movie, Josh, there was something unsettling about seeing these glorious shots of these African boys running behind the vehicle as if Beer, it felt to me, honestly, exploiting their joy and their innocence in a way. And it seemed very clearly to be setting up. And by the end of the film, I think it comes through in a similar shot at the very end of the movie, a bookend shot, where it does seem like they're there to facilitate, this is the big problem with a lot of these movies, to facilitate the white man's growth and development and issues with his problems, and not at all really about their problems. I will counter Josh a little bit and say, I'm with you on the complexity of what happens with that warlord. He doesn't save Africa, certainly. He does
not
save a few individual patients, but there's hardly a sense that he's brought...
To what end?
Yeah, he's brought meaningful change to this environment.
If
that's
anything,
definitely not there. He's maybe made it worse, but
yes.
But let me comment on that. The problem is that with that subplot with the warlord, where again, Beer acknowledges there's real moral complexity there, ultimately even, I think, clear hypocrisy in a choice he makes, I do feel like the movie treats the aftermath of that choice so ambiguously and really so simply, as if it's kind of like, oh, that's all it took, and it never comes back into play. He shows up in Africa again later, as if this whole event is water under the bridge. It would be easy to read it as a case of him delivering justice for these African people, and that is problematic.
First of all, it's absolutely right to have our antenna up for something like this when a movie is going to have this sort of narrative structure. And I had the same reaction as you did when it started out in Africa and would return there. And I thought, oh, this is just – it's just too tricky. There are so many cross-cultural pitfalls here.
Right.
I'd rather a filmmaker didn't try it. That said, I do think Beer and the film overall manage to make this work. And part of it is because of the complexity I mentioned. Part of it is because I don't see Anton as having saved anything. And I actually see when he's back in Africa, there he strikes me as a failure, a danger, a threat.
Maybe.
I don't know if the movie really draws attention to that. I think it's at least leaving that possibility there, that things are more complicated now than when we first saw him in his opening scenes, where he's very much, you know, the beloved man of the village who's giving mm-hmm. things to the kids and healing everyone.
Right.
I think there's a contrast there, enough of one. But this also ties into one larger thing I appreciate about this movie is that thematically, if it is going to be about the intractable nature of violence, I do like how it takes this both micro and macro view of it, and it places it within this one household mm-hmm. and what this kid is experiencing yeah. and echoing it in the larger world. And in a way, to me, it brings the two together by realizing, making us realize that what is going down, this sort of bullying or power grab, to use a more legitimate word for it, that's going down in this one village mm-hmm. that we may put as a problem over there, is actually the same power grab that's going on among us in our own homes. And so there's a closing of a gap to me. And we can see that this is something that's in all of our hearts. This isn't just an African issue. And I also think that the movie gives just enough time for me to the people that he serves. We don't get their stories. But we get enough conversations and dialogue to get a sense of what their lives are like, what they are facing outside of this medical care facility, that for me, I'd give it a pass for doing something that I think is probably just unwise in general to try to do. And even the camera work does play with this micro-macro idea. I really liked in the landscapes, which you mentioned, are just gorgeous, how often we'll get this faraway shot of a mountain range mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden the next will be an insert of like the pebbles or the ground. Did you notice that? Mm-hmm. A lot of times, and it would just again be this like collapsing. There's this sense of collapsing ideas and even visual ideas throughout the film. I liked the mirrors of the African landscapes and the Danish mm-hmm. seaside landscapes. Often those would be contrasted. So I do think that they're very careful to interweave these things in as meaningful a way as possible.
I think that's the only area where we really disagree, because there's no doubt the movie is trying to make that macro micro point, and I appreciate that point, and I appreciate what you're trying to suss out in terms of the terribleness of what's at the core of what's happening is ultimately the same. But it's not the same. There's a significant difference between any of the horrors we see play out
absolutely
in Denmark, right? And what we see when we're talking about a place that's being torn apart by genocide and what's happening to these people. And the problem is, Josh, I don't think Beer makes that distinction clear enough that she understands it. We really don't see any horror in these camps. We see a lot of injuries. We see injuries.
What happens to the women?
Gruesome shots, though. We see gruesome shots of patients while he's fixing them. But that is the only substitute, or that is a substitute for the real horror, the scale of the horror
we do
that
hear
these
from
people
the husbands.
Are suffering from.
The husbands share their stories. Again, it's not seen, but they do get a moment to describe to the doctor what they're going
through. But I never felt it. I never really felt the fear that I think those people must have been
living
under.
It's not a one-to-one. That's absolutely true. I mean, the kid's experience is the primary focus of the movie. There's no way around that.
In a Better World is out, available via Netflix and for rent via most digital platforms. If you agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We are planning to get to the next film in our Nordic cinema marathon, the fifth movie, La Havre, from Aki Kaurismäki, next week. That's a 2011 movie, and it's a Criterion Collection edition, so you can get that. It's also out on Netflix, DVD, iTunes, Amazon, Hulu. No excuses not to participate in this marathon with the next movie, La Havre. Take it back like you know I want you to.
Bill.
What?
What's the question? What do you want to answer? At what point are you going to be satisfied?
Well, the thing is, sadly for me, one question leads to another question, leads to another question, leads to five questions, leads to 10 questions, and it's a, you know, it's a geometrical thing.
We're not sitting here 50 years later, we're still talking about Kitty.
A clip there from the remarkable new documentary, The Witness, about the 50-year-old Kitty Genovese murder case. Genovese's brother, Bill, in that scene, who, as you heard, remains obsessed with the case 5 decades after his sister was killed. The Kitty Genovese case remains of interest to more than just Bill Genovese because of how it was covered in the press, specifically in the New York Times. In its coverage of the murder, the Times emphasized not the victim, the 28-year-old Kitty, and not the man who was convicted of the murder, but the witnesses, specifically the 38 alleged witnesses who, it was reported, did nothing to stop the murder from taking place and did nothing to save Genovese from dying. Among the after effects of the murder and the Times' coverage of it was the development of the 911 system. But was the Times reporting accurate? If so, how could his sister's neighbors have really been so callous? If not, has some of his crucial life choices been driven by a prevarication that morphed into myth? I had a chance to talk with the director of The Witness, James Solomon. He wrote the 2010 Robert Redford film, The Conspirator, and was a writer and executive producer of the 2007 ESPN series, The Bronx is Burning. The Witness is absolutely one of my favorite films of the year so far. Was excited to talk with James Solomon. Here's our conversation.
Exactly what was it you heard?
Save me, save me.
Didn't this frighten you or shock you?
No.
I was 16 when my sister Kitty was murdered in New York City. For years, I avoided the details of that night, but it's worse not knowing the truth.
James, my first exposure to the Kitty Genovese murder was actually in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, which I think I read maybe 10 or 12 years ago. He spends just a page or so on it. And without getting too much into it, it's fascinating to reread that part after seeing your movie because it becomes clear that Gladwell perhaps draws the right conclusion from the case, but as your movie shows, he might have based it on largely false information. When and how did you first become aware of this case?
Well, I'm a New Yorker, and it is such a seminal New York crime, 38 watched, no one helped. That basic narrative came to define New York City in many respects, beginning in the mid-1960s, and it sort of defined New York as this cold, heartless place, and cities in general. I'm sure Chicago bore the brunt of it as well. And so that's a story that you sort of grew up knowing. I was born the year after Kitty was murdered, so I didn't actually live through it, but I certainly grew up knowing about it. It wasn't until the late 1990s when there was an effort to reprint Abe Rosenthal's seminal account, 38 Witnesses, that's what it was called, 35th anniversary, that I actually began to really consider it as a possible basis for a screenplay. And I am by profession a screenwriter and often drawn to stories, iconic stories we think we know. And so that was the inception for me.
This is Bill Genovese's story. It's deeply personal. You're following him, following the trail of this case. So he's driving your narrative, but he isn't the storyteller, or he isn't the only storyteller anyway. How did you get involved with him, and how did you navigate that line between collaborator and filmmaker, and in your own way, witness to Bill's story?
Well, it's a good question. While developing a screenplay based on the iconic, the story that we all know about Kitty Genovese in the late 1990s, I set about, and this was a screenplay I was going to write in collaboration with two others, Joe Berlinger, the wonderful filmmaker, and Alfred Urey, the great playwright. The three of us had pitched to HBO a scripted film based on that iconic story. And so in the process of researching for that film, I met a number of people who were deeply and dramatically impacted by not just Kitty's death, but also her life, having known her. And what's striking immediately when you begin to research this, and particularly at that time, was how few people who were the most directly impacted, either by her death or life, had been heard from. That many, for decades, including Malcolm Gladwell, Freakonomics wrote about this, had opined on this story, but the people who were actually the most directly impacted had been silent. And I met Bill Genovese at that time, and the few things happen as soon as you meet Bill. One, and it takes about 2 minutes to experience it when you see it on film, and Bill is rather singular, an extraordinary guy, and what he's overcome in his life is really, truly remarkable, and the way he's overcome it. I think anyone who just watches the first few minutes of the film will experience that, as I did when I met him. But two other things sort of happen. One is that when you meet Bill, you meet Kitty, and we all know Kitty for the last half hour of her life, so to experience her life through Bill, because he was so close to her and he's able to sort of bring her alive. And the other thing that struck me, and I didn't realize at the time just how profoundly that story of the iconic story had impacted Bill, but he said to me at that time, I needed to prove that I would not only have been someone who opened the window that night, but would have gone down into the street. That's what he said to me in the late 1990s, and this was before there was any real question of the accuracy of that original story of bystanders not doing anything. That scripted project, nothing came of it. And in 2004, the New York Times, on the 40th anniversary of the murder of Kitty Genovese, revisited its own story and published an article in which they questioned whether, in fact, their original account had been accurate. That was the catalyst, and because Bill had been so deeply affected by that story, he needed and wanted to find out for himself what actually happened, and he allowed me to document that journey, which, as you point out, it took about 11 years.
So what was that collaboration like then in the physical process of shooting, where there are certain agendas you might have in terms of trying to get something in the can or explore a certain idea? And then, of course, he may have his own direction that he's trying to go. Did you ever have any issues with that?
Well, I think I learned very early on that there was a reason why people had maintained their privacy, secrecy, held on to their experiences for decades in relationship to this story, largely because a lot of what they had experienced was they were either felt guilt about or anger, or they were deeply private. And I began to understand that that really it was only through Bill that individuals would be willing to open up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a variety of reasons. He was so close to Kitty, and I think some people, particularly the witnesses that Bill found over the course of the 11 years, the witnesses in the apartments, they felt they owed it to Kitty to sort of share what happened in the apartments that night. And I think Bill being so close to Kitty is essentially a surrogate, but he's also somebody who has a really extraordinary ability to make people comfortable.
Yeah.
And that is in part a function of his disability. He has been a double amputee caused directly or indirectly, but very profoundly by that story of 38. And the experience of having had that disability since he was 19, and he said to me very early on, people are generally uncomfortable around somebody with the disability that I have, and I put them at ease. Hmm. And I think he put so many of the people that he talked to at ease, and I think also, and this is really perhaps the most consequential part of it, is that Bill's understanding of trauma, physical and emotional, has made him, in a sense, uniquely able to understand other people.
Yeah.
And so they were willing to open up to Bill.
Do you think you were one of the 38 that were reported to have done nothing?
I suppose I could be. I could be counted in with that.
Mm.
I woke up.
Yeah.
I looked out the window and I went back to bed. But I wasn't in that group. That was not my behavior in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In my research, your name and your mom's name is down there as saying, I heard George, George, he's done it to me. George, he's done it to me twice. And then please help me. So you and your mom, you were probably counted as part of the 38.
To your original question, which was the relationship between a filmmaker and a subject, in this instance, it was extremely intimate, but I'm sure for so many documentarians, it's the same. We had a very skeletal crew. I knew that the people that had remained silent, most significantly was Kitty's own family, who had not talked about their experiences for a half century, were doing so on a leap of faith. And I made a choice very early on that I was going to follow and be patient. Bill's journey, which is a screenwriter where you can write yourself in and out of scenes, is something that isn't, you're always not so patient. As a documentary filmmaker, clearly you wait and allow things to unravel as they happen. And certainly the way this journey unraveled was a shock to me and I know to Bill.
Maybe jumping off of that nicely here, we came into this segment with a clip from the movie. It's where Bill's brother, one of his brothers, is asking him when enough will be enough. When is this going to end? And you just were talking about being a screenwriter by trade and you're used to dictating how the story is going to go. If Bill doesn't know exactly what closure and resolution he needs, then you don't really know what closure or resolution your film needs either, I imagine. And I figured that could be daunting, exhilarating, or both.
Yeah, well, I think you just nailed it. It's both. It's absolutely unsettling in good and bad ways. You know, the question that his son Matthew asks of Bill, you know, when is it going to be over, is a question I certainly asked myself on many, many occasions. The film is in many respects sort of serial-like, sort of multiple investigations. One, Bill is trying to find out the answer to something that has fascinated people for decades. What happened in the apartments that night? He also then, as he begins to realize that story, this iconic story of Kitty's murder is deeply flawed, he begins to examine the genesis of that story, how it came to be. But there are also other mysteries that he's unraveling. Who was Kitty, this person that he only knew in a certain way? And who was this person that killed his sister? Why would Winston Mosley have done what he did? So all of these mysteries Bill is sort of pursuing, and in a certain order as he tries to unravel multiple truths. But as the film sort of pitches or turns in a certain way, what Bill is chasing is these sort of unanswerable questions of life, sort of the why. And only in the middle of making the film did I begin to have a sense and understanding, and largely because of personal experience, that some of the questions that Bill was seeking the answers to were those kinds of questions that all of us seek, and at times it's almost impossible to get at the answers to.
Yeah, without a doubt. My co-producer, Sam Van Halgren, who has also seen the film, we both loved it, and one of the things we were discussing is how the movie is ultimately so profound, probably because it doesn't seem to know how profound it is, or if it does know, and if you as a filmmaker know, you were at least able to not try to spell those themes out, some of which we'll get to, but just let Bill's story unfold.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, I think it's there are sort of tangible questions that Bill is seeking in the very beginning, which all of us would be curious about. What happened in the most, start with, what happened in the apartments that night? Why didn't people act, or did they act? That's sort of a fundamental question, which I think is partly why this story has fascinated people for so long. And for Bill, there's a deeply important reason why he needs to know, because that story shaped his life and his family's life in so many ways. But where it leads him is into a far deeper place of not what just happened in those apartments, but who are we and how do we come to be? What kinds of stories do we tell ourselves over the course of our lives or in the middle of the night that shape who we are?
Yeah. And that's one of my favorite themes for movies and for art in general to explore. I think that's one of the reasons I connect so strongly to the material here. It is about, and it's about many things, as you've touched on, but it's about our obsession individually and collectively with myths, our need for stories that help define for us who we are. This idea of the 38 witnesses who watched and didn't help fed a sense of the worst of who we are and who we maybe should be. And the horrible notion of so many people being unwilling to get involved and help, as you noted, drove Bill to be active and not passive. It actually drove him to enlist to go to Vietnam rather than avoiding it or waiting to get drafted. So was that something specifically you wanted to explore or knew you were going to explore going in, or did it emerge while filming?
I mean, I honestly didn't have any idea in what direction the narrative would take itself. I just knew the starting point where Bill started in 2004, and that was this story that we'd all come to know that was credited with leading to the 911 emergency system, to Good Samaritan laws, to neighborhood watch groups like the Guardian Angels. But this seminal story, taught in sociology classes, peers in, as you point out, Gladwell's book and Freakonomics, 3 months ago was the centerpiece of an episode of Girls, and a month before that, the centerpiece of an episode of Law & Order Special Victims Unit. This story, which has exerted such a hold, may not be true, and it had a profound effect on not just our consciousness, but more importantly, on the family. And yet, in the course of Bill's journey, he uncovers, reveals, learns that the kitty didn't actually die alone. This story of urban apathy and indifference actually has a hero after all, a woman named Sophia Farrar, who was Kitty's neighbor, in the middle of the night, rushed out in her nightclothes down a rear alley, having no idea who was outside, and then pushed her way inside a vestibule, having no idea who was inside, and found Kitty and cradled her in her arms, and it was in her arms that Kitty died. Now, it wasn't just that none of us knew it. The family, Bill's, Kitty's own family, did not know this. For decades, they thought their daughter or sister had died alone, and she'd actually died in the arms of a friend. Now, that alone raises questions about that story, but also profoundly impacts the way one begins to think about choices one in Bill's own life, choices that he made. And that becomes almost a launch point to sort of find, well, this story isn't what it was said to be, this iconic story. Why? Why? Mm-hmm. What happened? How did it come? And if it's not true, what does it mean?
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with James Solomon, the director of the great new documentary, The Witness, which opened here in Chicago this weekend. And James, I'm very torn here because as an interviewer, I want to ask you specific questions and I want to ask specific questions about specific choices you and Bill make. But I would very much prefer that everyone listening see the movie knowing roughly the same amount about it as I knew going in. That said, there are two scenes in the movie that provoked as strong a reaction in me as anything I've seen in a while. That kind of visceral hair standing up on your neck feeling where your breath becomes a little bit shorter as you're watching it. And the first one is the scene where Bill meets with Stephen Mosley, the son of Winston Mosley, who killed Kitty. There's so much going on in this conversation. There's one wrinkle we learn at the end of the sequence. I won't spoil for listeners, but there's the kind of tension anyone would expect when two people are sitting in a room, when one is a victim and the other person is a family member of the perpetrator of the crime. There's Bill trying to get something out of this, right? Emotionally, intellectually, from Stephen. We expect that. But there's Stephen also trying to get something from Bill, which is a little bit more tangible, perhaps, and we don't expect that. That raises the stakes of the conversation. And there's a whole lot more of what we were discussing in terms of the storytelling, the self-rationalization and denial. We realized pretty quickly that Stephen and his family are victims too, which is something I hadn't thought of at all as that scene began. These people have also constructed their own set of myths to handle living with Winston's actions. I just have to ask what it was like for you being in that room watching that scene unfold.
Well, there is a sort of a high wire aspect to it, in the sense that you, after a half century, families never met. And Bill, he's the ultimate truth seeker. It's worth mentioning that in Vietnam, Bill was a field intelligence scout, which basically put him always a few days ahead of his platoon seeking the truth. And he has brought that skill set to his investigation. And he's indomitable and will track or seek the truth wherever it leads. And it leads him to meet with Winston Mosley's son, Stephen, as you point out. Now, what's extraordinary in that scene is that, having gone into it, Bill had no idea. And it's really not a scene, it's real life. So in that meeting, Bill had no understanding, none, of what Stephen Mosley's own family's perception was of Bill and his family. Mm-hmm. And so what unfolds, as you allude to, is these, in a sense, competing and really conflicting personal narratives that each has of the other. The whole film, in many respects, is about false narratives and the power of false narratives, the way we might hear something in the middle of the night and come up with a narrative that allows us to go back to sleep and not have to call the police or act. Or over the course of a half century, the stories that we have within our families that could be a photograph, could be a clip or an anecdote that kind of shapes the way we perceive other members of our family. And oftentimes these stories are for our own survival, that we need them, whether they're true or not, and we believe them to be true, but we need them to get through the night or to get through life. Mm-hmm. And what you see in this particular encounter between Stephen and Bill is two people with narratives that they have constructed. What's extraordinary about that scene, in my mind, and it speaks to what makes Bill the most remarkable, not character, person, frankly, that I have ever had the experience of telling, describing, or portraying a narrative of, is that his humanity comes through. His innate understanding of Stephen Mosley's need for that narrative. Mm-hmm. And rather than bludgeoning Stephen with the truth, he gently shares it with him.
Absolutely.
And I think it's what strikes so many who see that scene with just how kind and understanding and empathic Bill is in that moment. And he is with everyone over and over again. This is not an agenda film. It's not a guy with a pre-existing understanding or expectation of what the truth will be. He just follows it. And he's dogged and relentless. It is also, and the reason, it is not because it's an investigation. This is a film really about, this is a love story. It's a sibling love story.
Mm. Yeah.
Bill is reclaiming his sister Kitty's life from her infamous death.
There's also a harrowing scene that follows not too long after that where we get more or less a reenactment of Kitty's murder, where an actress is hired by Bill to portray her and to scream on the street and be out there for as long as Kitty was. And at first I thought that might be kind of a social experiment. And I was very fearful of what the results would be, where maybe it would actually prove that this myth about urbanites being too apathetic and fearful to help would actually be proven true. And of course, then we see that it's not so much about that. There were probably some technicalities that forced you to share what was going on with the neighborhood. It really is more about Bill experiencing it. And I'll just say, I watched this movie at home via a screener link hooked up to my TV. And as I realized what was about to play out, I stopped it for a couple minutes. And I just kind of walked around my living room to prepare myself for it. Obviously not something I'd be able to do in the theater. There's nothing gruesome that happens. There's nothing even shocking. We know how it's going to play out. But even for 10 minutes after, I was really on edge. And I just love for you to talk about the decision to stage that.
Well, now, this is a sort of a perfect example, I think you alluded to, Adam, where sort of your audience is going in and they're now getting, you know, in a sense, folks listening are thinking, gosh, I don't want to go see that. And I can understand why, honestly. There is a kind of initial cringe factor, and you're referring to it in a sense, stopping the play button, hitting standby.
I mean, so that all is a compliment, too, by the way, to the power of the film.
Yeah, no, and I take it that way, and sort of aware of it. So just so your listeners understand, for the past 50 years, Bill Genovese, Kitty's younger brother by 12 years, has been replaying the narrative of what took place that night in his mind over and over again. And I think any of your viewers who have, particularly those who have lost someone early, could be a sibling, could also be a parent or child, replay over and over and over and over again in their mind their loved one's last moments, last minutes, last months. And Bill has been doing that for very understandable reasons, because this being such a public crime and being such a horrific crime.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that the fact that for 11 years, Bill had been returning over and over and over again to the location where his sister had been murdered in Kew Gardens, Queens. And that block where she was murdered, Austin Street, is exactly, but for the signage, exactly the way it was a half century ago. Nothing has changed. So you were essentially standing on an existing standing set. And Bill, both by being there, has also, in a sense, been experiencing, reliving, and getting as close to that moment as he possibly can, as possibly anyone can. But he's also became very, very familiar with the neighbors and the neighborhood. And so when Bill decided that he would seek to experience as much as he humanly could what it sounded like on the street, and that's what propelled him. So he doesn't hire a Winston Mosley actor. There isn't someone who's stabbing anyone. It's an actress who's recreating the sounds on the street, very different. For several months prior, the city, the local police, the neighbors had all been notified, and we had been filming in that neighborhood for years, so they all knew Bill. And that goes back to my prior point, which is people who appear in the film and the neighbors and the neighborhood only would have permitted and allowed and were willing because of Bill. And so on that, the choice, the decision to recreate, I think, to reenact, is in a sense what Bill went in thinking, I'm paraphrasing Bill, I'm a scientist, sort of an ethologist, I'm trying to understand sights and angles and point of view. I don't think he fully understand just how emotionally immersive and cathartic the experience would be. But throughout his entire lifetime, he's been trying to get as close to Kitty, the person he loved more than anyone, who he describes in the film as a mother and a father to himself. He's been trying to get as close to her as possible, and this was a way that he thought or felt he could get close to her in a certain way. And it was certainly not testing the neighborhood. It speaks to his relentless quest to connect with the person he loved. Mm-hmm. And lost.
Yeah. I was curious as well about your decision to use some animation at various points in the film. I think that it obviously provides some clarity where it's very much needed for us as viewers, but it also provides a creative solution to some visual problems that you have. What was that process like?
So there are lots of documents that Bill gathers over the course of his decade plus. And how do you externalize what Bill is gathering informationally? How do you portray that? And in my mind, the animations were done by phenomenal animators in London called the Moth Collective. And I found their work, a student film that they had made, that one of the principals had made at art school in London, on the internet. I was looking for a way of portraying what Bill's gathering of information was in the way to him. And in many respects, when you gather information, it's sketchy. It's not fully formed. It's pieces. It's thin lines, not fully formed either live action or fully formed animation. And so the work that the animators did, and they did a beautiful job, is portraying this notion of pieces of information that aren't fully formed and conclusive. And they're also reflective of his whiteboards, which is what Bill used to gather and to assemble all the information that he was collecting over the course of time. I also, Robert Rauschenberg is an artist whose work I deeply admire, and he uses collage, and in a sense, what Bill was doing was using all these different elements to assemble some elusive truth,
yeah,
whether it's newspaper articles or fragments of information or anecdote or detective reports, trial transcripts, medical reports, all that are pieced together to create, in a sense, a collage of a truth that, as we've talked about, is very, very elusive.
Yeah. My last question for you, James. You touched on how you originally envisioned this as a scripted project for HBO, and your background as a screenwriter, if you look at some of the other work you've done, The Bronx is Burning, The Conspirator, these are rooted in historical fact, but they are, of course, dramas. Was making a documentary something you always envisioned doing, and are you going to make more, or was the documentary just the best vehicle for this material?
Well, I'll say this with a sense of, I guess the best way I could describe it is, it's formidable to realize that as a screenwriter, I couldn't and I can't possibly have come up with the scenes that occur in the film the way real life wrote them. And that's rather daunting, honestly, as I go back to trying to write screenplays. There has been no project, no experience I've ever had that's meant more to me, that has been more satisfying and in every respect and more, I think, compelling than the experience of having followed Bill these past 10 plus years. And I certainly didn't set out, as you know, as we discussed, to make a documentary. When the movie opened at the New York Film Festival, Joe Berlinger and Alfred Urey wrote Driving Miss Daisy, and I'm sure all your listeners know Joe's fine work, Paradise Lost, Metallica, fabulous filmmaker, and they both turned to me afterwards and they said, thank God we didn't make that scripted film, because the documentary wouldn't have happened. Bill's investigation may very well have, and most likely would have happened, but it would not have been documented. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would want and will want to make documentaries in the future without question. The question always becomes, will the story come along that is as compelling as right. the one I've been privileged to tell?
Right. It was a privilege to talk with you, certainly to meet Bill on screen and to watch the story unfold. It's a stunning film, and I wish you all the best of luck with it. Thank you, James.
Thank you so much for having me on and for your very kind words about the film, and your program is fabulous. Thank you.
At what point are you going to be satisfied?
50 years later, we're still talking about Kitty.
I can't stop until I feel like it's over.
Yeah,
like,
when is it over?
I'll know when it's over.
My thanks again to James Solomon. Yeah, this movie, Josh, could have made my top five of the best films of the year so far had I seen it before that taping. I saw it a few days after.
Would have been
actually.
Two documentaries on your list.
Yeah,
how
there
about
you
that?
Go. I think it probably would have bumped out Born to be Blue, that Ethan Hawke film, which I do love. But The Witness is a very, very powerful film. I'm confident that once you see it, it will be a surefire golden brick contender. The Witness is playing now at the Gene Siskel Film Center here in Chicago. Depending on when you're hearing this, it might be too late. And of course, depending on how much more you want to hear from James Solomon after that wonderful chat, he is doing a Skype Q&A on Saturday night after the movie at the Siskel. And if you're curious to see the movie, you want to see where it's playing around the country, you can do that at kittygenovesefilm.com. We will link to it in our show notes as well at filmspotting.net. You can also follow the film at The Witness Film on Twitter. Also out in limited release this weekend, Absolutely Fabulous, the movie.
Can it be as good as the series, Adam? What do you think?
I don't know. Did you watch Absolutely Fabulous, the series?
I did not.
I did not either, sadly. Cafe Society, the new Woody Allen film with Kristen Stewart and Jesse Eisenberg, equals the latest from Like Crazy director Drake Doremus with, what do you know, Kristen Stewart and Nicholas Hoult. And Under the Sun, this is a documentary that offers a rare glimpse at the life of an ordinary family in North Korea. And based on what I know about this film, you have to put ordinary family in quotes,
okay,
because they very much were set up, as you might imagine, by the government to portray an ordinary family. It's a doc that sounds pretty fascinating, Josh. I hope we get a chance to see it. Our friend Melissa Taminga says it offers a complex, poignant portrait of life in a rigid regime. Out in wide release, Ice Age Collision Course. I'm going to have to take my kids to another Ice Age movie.
Is this the third or fourth? There's a debate in our house how many there actually are.
My gut answer is this is the fourth.
Sounds,
I feel like there are
right.
three.
Yeah, okay.
You'd think that there was something we could search and find the answer to this question.
That'd be nice.
Lights Out, a horror film starring Maria Bello, and Star Trek Beyond. So I want to see Star Trek Beyond. I kind of like those movies. Want to see what Justin Lin does with the material.
I think I'm going to go to the screening tomorrow night.
Are you?
So I can report back.
Report back. And I am, of course, intrigued by Cafe Society, though I shouldn't say of course, because I don't get that intrigued by Woody Allen's latest efforts.
What's the last one you've seen?
That's a great question. It seems to be every other year or every about three films I actually even bother to see them anymore after being such a big fan of his work.
I think for me it's been Blue Jasmine, to be honest with you.
Really?
Probably.
Yeah, I'd have to look at the filmography, but based on what little I know about it and what others have said about it, I am curious to see Cafe Society. But we're not going to talk about either of those films next week on the show. As we mentioned earlier, some discussion about doing Jason Bourne, which opens on the 29th. But right now, the leader in the clubhouse is The Fitz, a movie I don't know a whole lot about, but I know, Josh, you saw it and can recommend that it's not only worth people's time, but worthy of discussion.
Yes, and worthy of Golden Brick contention as well, because
okay,
a first-time filmmaker.
Okay, and Le Havre, the latest in our contemporary Nordic cinema marathon, is up next as well. You can catch up with the marathon or all of our past reviews, interviews, and top five lists over at filmspotting.net. While you're there, vote in the current Film Spotting poll. Which director won the 2000s? I don't think you can slow down this juggernaut, though. And if you haven't already, we encourage you to check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, Film Spotting SVU and The Next Picture Show. You can find both in iTunes.
If you have a comment about the show, just email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. You might just hear it featured on an upcoming show. We had a lot of those on last week's episode. That was nice to include. You can find Film Spotting on Facebook and on Twitter at Film Spotting. That's Adam. I'm at Larson on Film. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week was by The Heavy, comes from the album Hurt and the Merciless. More information is at theheavy.co.uk. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
So go ahead and just pull the mic up to you. You can throw some headphones on too.
Yeah, you'll be able to hear us.
Have you heard these little segments at the end of the show?
I actually enjoy these little segments. Yeah,
it's crazy. Other people
you're
do
talking
too.
To probably, well, certainly a more faithful listener than any of our other family members, I would say.
That's for sure.
So
it's strange, though. My donations never get announced at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've made a few contributions probably in one form or another over the years to this show. But so explain a little bit. Josh gave me a little bit of the story here. But as I was told, you essentially had options for a Father's Day gift, Father's Day experiences, and you chose this.
See, he sounds like Addie and B, doesn't he?
And you're shocked at this?
No, not totally, because I know that you do listen to the show. I see you at the live shows.
Well, the options were, I know one was a White Sox game.
What was the third option? I forget.
I think it was Joe Daniels.
Just hanging out at the bar neighborhood.
Right. And imagine that. He chose this.
Yeah.
I can see that.
So given Joe Daniels and the way the White Sox are going,
this is it.
Easy decision.
Okay.
I took him to dinner, too.
You did?
Yeah. Like people look at me, that I was just telling them, that's what B said. It's like, I'm glad you're taking him to dinner. Or no, Addie said, I'm glad you're taking him to dinner because otherwise that would be kind of sad.
Your kids were just abusing you for this.
He
huh?
would just go sit and listen to you and Mr. Kempinar talk for 4 hours.
Oh, that hurts me that she even calls me that.
I don't want to hear you that. Into it. Oh, yeah, I know, Mr. Kempinar.
The McChicken sandwich was good.
That sounds like Josh's speed, actually. So
last year, my Father's Day gift was, I said, you could come watch me get a haircut. So I'm stepping up my game.
Okay. Well, I should be really happy with anything I get from you for Christmas.
There you go. Exactly.
So this is the time here during this warm-up that we talk about what we have seen over the weekend. We're obviously going to talk about some of the things that we have seen. I had a really busy weekend. No time for anything but the things I had to prepare for the show. So I've got nothing to add. It's great, Mr. Larson, that we have you here to fill in for me.
Now you're calling him Mr. Larson.
I am.
Like
I'm going
aging.
To.
You can just go with Dave.
He clearly deserves that respect.
Okay.
I don't. What did you see? Have you been watching any movies?
I saw...
You had a strange double feature Sunday, I noticed, on Letterboxd.
One of which was...
He's on Letterboxd?
Oh, yeah.
I don't follow your dad on Letterboxd. That's a problem.
Let's get on it, will you?
I will. I'm going to do it right now.
I saw Primal Fear.
Oh, yeah.
You know it.
I do. I do know, and I'll tell you how in a second. Besides the fact that it's kind of well-known, I have a story behind it.
Partly because it was a Chicago film, and a lot of good Chicago scenes, which was one of the highlights, if that says anything about
it. Is that
the
first movie. Time you
saw it? Yeah.
And, that was Ed
and
Norton's
debut,
big breakout.
Yeah, debut for Edward Norton with this sort of complex character. So it was tawdry in a good part.
You hadn't seen it before?
Never saw it before.
But why did you follow that up, or you followed Chocolat up with that? Was that the same day you watched both of those?
Actually, I've been following Adam, and I'll take parts of a movie over maybe a month or so.
Ah, the truth is coming out.
I love it.
Yeah, and it works, Adam, I have to say.
It does work.
Yeah.
Josh is dubious. But...
I have to review my notes from time to time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
To be fair, you usually don't rate things on Letterboxd, so
no.
I suppose you're getting around that.
I don't consider myself a critic.
Well, if you're not watching the whole movie, I'm glad you're not rating them.
So Primal Fear, my senior year at Grinnell, that movie, I think it came out a year later. So they were auditioning, and they were doing an open casting call in Chicago. Now, of course, I am not an actor, but my college roommate, Kevin, very much an actor, the guy who runs Illinois Shakespeare now, is the artistic director. And I don't know if he ever considered going or even knew about it, but a friend of ours who was also in the theater program and was a really good actor at Grinnell named Jason Nagel went to Chicago and did the audition. And the story goes again.
Wait, is this for the Norton part?
Yeah, for the Norton part.
Wow.
It was an open call. So the story goes, and again, I don't know if this has been a little bit embellished over the years, if it's apocryphal, or if it's totally accurate, but supposedly he actually did get a callback. Like, he made it past the initial casting call. And during the audition, they had to do a scene where the Ed Norton character gets really angry and kind of violent or gets very accusatory with someone. I can't remember what the line in the sides were, but
did
whatever.
Did you see this one or did you skip this scene?
I replayed that scene again and again.
So everybody is going up there. This is the lesson about trying to stand out in an audition, right? It's an open call. So people are just going up and they're auditioning and everybody is really big. They're getting really angry and they're really yelling and letting the other person have it. And Jason supposedly walked up and said something, you know, the line was like, let me have it or something like that. And just really sinister under his voice got right up in their faces and said, let me have it. And that that propelled him to the next
stage.
To the next
stage.
And
then he lost out.
But then
to
he
Norton.
Did not. Yeah, Ed Norton. So now Ed Norton has had the career he's had, and
that's, you know, a respectful way to lose out a part, though, to Ed Norton, to his breakthrough performance. I mean, you got to feel okay about that.
Absolutely. So, okay, Primal Fear, you saw it.
And then our church, I started a film club with the church, so we said Chocolat the night, you know, just before that.
When did you guys watch all of it?
Is this the Lasse Hallström movie?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. With Juliette Binoche, right?
Yep.
How'd
and,
it go over?
It's a variety of films we view because we picked the AFI's 100 list and people voted. And we put the names in a hat, and we draw out the next one. So we're going from Chocolat to Pan's Labyrinth.
Wait a second. There's no way Chocolat is on that list.
It
is?
It was on the list.
Really?
Yeah. Well, no. There's one guy who threw some names in the hat that I didn't know was happening.
That sounds more like it.
And, yeah.
You have a saboteur in your film group.
There are four out-of-sort kind of movies. You know, they just didn't fit into the pattern. So,
right.
Yeah.
So then do you have a discussion about it afterwards and
we
stuff?
We do.
Yeah. And do you lead those, or is there no leader?
No, unfortunately, there's an academic in the group. And I
seriously
think Josh may know who this is. And
I'm not going to say anything.
And he offered for Pan's Labyrinth. He said, I taught this in a course at the college, and I'd be happy to lead the discussion. Well, I'd like these people to leave by midnight.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is going to go longer than an average film spotting episode.
I said, you know, and I won't say his name. I said, you know, what would be helpful is if you could give a few leading questions after the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He offered to do a setup, which would probably be longer than the movie. So we worked out an agreement.
Nice. It's all about compromise.
I like that choice, though.
Yeah.
So other than us double dating to go see Ghostbusters,
yes,
what did you do?
I freaked the kids out with Rear Window.
Yeah, I saw that on Letterboxd.
That was fun. And they liked it.
Okay, I knew one of them really liked it. Yeah. One was maybe a little freaked out.
Yeah, she was. She said, I don't want to watch these kinds of movies very often. But to me, that means we can from time to time. So that went over well. And we also watched Shall We Dance, the next film in our Fred Astaire Ginger Rogers marathon. Not one of their strongest, I'd say.
No?
But
okay.
It had its moments. Good stuff from the supporting characters, good comedy there, but yeah, certainly no Swing Time, but still good to check it off the list.
That
was
pretty great.
That was about it, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get to anything, so.
Slacker. You were too wowed by Ghostbusters. What more cinema do I need?
So true. All right, well, I think we're warmed up. I think you should just stay on the mics. Did you see Ghostbusters?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, then I guess you're out.
Or in a better world. So you're going to be sitting here not knowing what we're talking about.
No clue. But, well, most of our listeners.
I guess so.